From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A face-to-face meeting was not to be yesterday at the United Nations for President Obama and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. But something big and new is in the air between the U.S. and Iran after decades of unrelieved hostility and years of high tension over a possible Iranian nuclear bomb. Even Iran's supreme leader is talking about heroic flexibility. President Obama responded with openness and wariness yesterday. A breakthrough could solve a lot of problems, but is it real? This hour, On Point dreams of a diplomatic breakthrough with Iran. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you buying, welcoming the new tone out of Tehran? Are you saying, show me? Show me what? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will go to Tehran in a moment for a sense of how Iranians are watching all this, and they are. But joining me first today in Washington is Julie Pace, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. She's been at the UN this week taking it all in. Julie Pace, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
How's the White House assessing what went down yesterday in New York? Are they satisfied? Are they not? What's the White House position?
I think the best way to put it is cautiously optimistic. They feel like Rouhani, the new Iranian president, is showing signs of being more moderate compared to some of the hardline presidents that we've seen in the past from the Iranians. But they don't yet know what's behind this rhetoric, because that's all it is right now. It's just rhetoric. And so there's going to be a lot of focus on a meeting that's happening on Thursday at the UN where John Kerry, other foreign ministry level counterparts from the P5 plus one are going to meet with Iran's foreign minister, Zarif, and that's going to be the first test of what kind of substance is going to be offered by the Iranians, whether there are going to be concessions made on the nuclear programs. And I think we'll know a little bit more coming out of that meeting where this new relationship is going to go.
Was the White House disappointed, first of all, that the President Obama and Iran's new president did not meet, even pass each other in a hallway yesterday? Or were they relieved politically, domestically for the president? What, Julie?
Well, they certainly wanted this meeting. This was something that in the days leading up to the UN meeting, the White House had said repeatedly that they were open to this, that this reflected President Obama's longstanding policy, that he would be willing to meet with rogue leaders, anti-American leaders, as long as they showed that they were willing to have a dialogue with the U.S. So they certainly wanted this meeting. I think in the end, there were certainly risks that would have come with having the even a brief encounter with Rouhani. They would have had to have had the encounter before Rouhani went to the floor of the UN. And that's incredibly risky because they would have had no idea what he was about to say in his international debut. I think that the one thing that the White House has made clear and the Iranians made clear is that even the encounter that they were discussing was not going to be a substantive meeting. It would have been just a handshake.
Sure.
There are other opportunities. This could happen next year at the UN. So I think that there's probably a bit of disappointment from the White House, but also some relief that they perhaps got away, missed an opportunity that could have gone poorly for them.
And what about Rouhani's speech itself? How did that go down with the White House, with the American contingent there? I mean, he said, there may be, what do you say, Rouhani said, find a framework to manage our differences, but there was also criticism of the United States and more. What do they think of his speech at the UN?
Absolutely. So there's two parts of the speech that I think are critical. One is the fact that he did say that the Iranians are open to starting nuclear negotiations with the U.S. without delay. That's a big sign that the U.S. is hopeful about. At the same time, he said that the conditions that need to be met for those negotiations to happen are a recognition from the international community that Iran has to maintain its right to enrich uranium. Well, that's the same thing that we've heard from previous Iranian regimes. The White House says that they're not surprised that Rouhani held on to that position publicly. Again, they're waiting to see what happens in private negotiations. And again, Rouhani is not just playing to his international audience in these speeches. He's playing to his domestic audience. And that's why you saw him take some shots at American sanctions. He said that they were violent, that they violated human rights. He also criticized Obama's drone policy, saying that the world must condemn the killing of innocent civilians, even in the name of fighting terrorism. So some of the rhetoric may have been less bombastic than what we were used to from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, but a lot of the lines were similar. They really do recall things that Ahmadinejad and other Iranian leaders have said in the past.
And now the action attention turns to Secretary of State John Kerry and meetings coming right up starting tomorrow. Julie Pace in Washington, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Thank you so much for a couple of minutes there, Julie.
Thanks, Tom.
A little bit from yesterday. Here was President Obama speaking at the United Nations General Assembly, saying that a diplomatic option must be tried.
The roadblocks may prove to be too great, but I firmly believe the diplomatic path must be tested.
And then in the afternoon, the new president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, talking to the same General Assembly, promoting diplomacy with the United States over Iran's nuclear program.
We can arrive at a framework to manage our differences. To this end, equal footing, mutual respect, and the recognized principles of international law should govern the interactions.
Let's go to Iran. Joining me now from Tehran is Farideh Farhi, professor of political science at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and former professor at the University of Tehran. Farideh Farhi, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for joining us from Tehran. What reaction did you witness yesterday? Were people listening, watching? What did you hear Iranians say?
Well, certainly quite a few people were watching. First of all, they watched President Obama, and I would say many people were quite pleased by his conciliatory tone and the way he managed to give attention as well as respect to all levels of power in Iran, not trying to make a distinction among various levels of power. He mentioned the fact that the religious leader of Iran had issued an edict, and he also acknowledged the important role the Iranian election had played and the Iranian people have played in changing the direction of Iran since the election. So it was, I would say people were pleasantly surprised at the way he spoke and opened the path for negotiations, and the fact that he explicitly mentioned that he had directed Secretary Kerry to begin discussions with Foreign Minister Zarif within the frame of P5+1, again, a very, very important step. Clearly, there was a lot of anticipation in Iran. Everybody was watching and to see whether there was going to be a handshake. And I would say there was a little bit of disappointment among some groups that expected or were hoping that that would happen and create sort of a stir. At the same time, I think there is an understanding that these expectations have to be managed, that there was this process cannot move forward very fast. In fact, if it does move forward very fast, it has the potential of becoming dangerously unstable. That is to say, there is a potential for a breakdown. So I would say there was a disappointment, a momentary disappointment, but now slowly there is a gradual realization that a difficult path has begun. It is going to be difficult, but nevertheless, it has begun. And because of that, there is, as was mentioned before, a cautious optimism in Iran as well.
Farideh, does the Iranian public, as far as you can make out, do they appear to really want a change in U.S.-Iran relationships because of sanctions or whatever motivation? Do they really want it? And if they do, does that drive Iran's clerical leadership, which has not always responded in a very welcoming way to democratic impulses there?
Well, Mr. Rouhani ran explicitly on a platform of improving relations with the world and as well as trying to open a channel to discuss the troubled relationship with the United States. And within that context, of course, easing of the sanctions is a very important component of that. And he won handily among a whole slew of candidates. He received a majority vote, absolute majority. So, he was allowed to win. That is to say,
he was allowed to win by the powers that be.
Across the board responded and positively to electoral participation. 70% of the population participated in the election, and that participation made Mr. Rouhani's election possible. So I would say the Iranian people have made a point that they have a say in the direction of Iran's foreign policy. And I think it should be noted that the Iranian leadership has responded to that.
Allowed to run, explicit in his campaign that he wanted to go in this direction, now explicit with the entire world. We're going to dive on in and look at this. It's great to have you for a few minutes here from Tehran. Farideh Farhi from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the United States, Iran, and the diplomacy moment we are seeing unfold just in this handful of days, looking at what's promising, what's possible, what's real here. Sound from yesterday, President Obama, again, talking with the General Assembly, saying that the U.S. is encouraged by President Rouhani, the new Iranian president's recent statements.
We are encouraged that President Rouhani received from the Iranian people a mandate to pursue a more moderate course. And given President Rouhani's stated commitment to reach an agreement, I am directing John Kerry to pursue this effort with the Iranian government.
And later yesterday, the new president of Iran himself saying peace is within reach.
In recent years, a dominant voice has been repeatedly heard. The military option is on the table. Against the backdrop of this illegal and ineffective contention, let me say loud and clear that peace is within reach.
Peace within reach. But it's been a long road. There's been a lot of talk along the way. Is this something really new? And if it is, what could it mean? Joining me now from Syracuse, New York, is Mirzad Borjardeh, Director of the Middle East Studies Program at Syracuse University, President of the International Society of Iranian Studies. Mirzad, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Washington is Patrick Clausen, Director of Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he directs the Iran Security Initiative. Patrick, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Mirzad Borjardeh, what do you see going on here? What did you hear yesterday that mattered? And do we have a truly changing context for this relationship?
Right. I think, you know, looking at President Obama's speech, I was impressed both by what I heard and what I didn't hear. In terms of what was impressive, the president's announcement that the U.S. government is not seeking regime change in Iran, in a way acknowledging the past interferences in affairs of Iran, referring to the 1953 coup, talking about how Iranians were poisoned in the war with Iraq, and also acknowledging that Iran can have a peaceful nuclear program, but no bombs. I think those were the interesting things that he said. As far as interesting things that did not appear in the talk, there were no more talk of all options are on the table. There was no attempt to once again separate the supreme leader from the president, nor to create a cleavage between the ruling elite and the people. And so I think these were the positive signals that President Obama sent to the Iranian side. As far as President Rouhani's speech, I think it was more a speech that was sort of long on ethics and short on policy suggestions. In some ways, one can say it was Khatami-esque, recalling the former president of Iran who talked about dialogue of civilizations.
Yep.
But it was very interesting that there was no bombastic talk, conspiracy theory a la Ahmadinejad about 9/11, not denying of the Holocaust, and instead saying, look, we have our differences on the nuclear issue as well as Syria, but we can manage these and there can be a peaceful solution. So I think this is a good start for a relationship that has been troubled for 34 years.
We'll dive on in to look at the reality behind the rhetoric, but to stick with the speeches for a minute, Petra Clausen, I mean, the headline on your essay yesterday was talk is cheap. Nevertheless, talk sets a tone. Tone can be important. What were you most drawn to? What were you looking at in yesterday's speeches?
Well, certainly President Obama forcefully articulated that the United States is going to continue to be a major actor in the Middle East and that the United States is not going to be isolationist and that the U.S. cares deeply about the threats to security coming out of the Middle East. And I think that should be a reminder that the United States wants an agreement with Iran, but if there isn't an agreement with Iran, the United States is not going to accept further proliferation of nuclear weapons in the region. From President Rouhani, we heard a lot of nice statements about peace, and that's good. And it's better to have his smile rather than Ahmadinejad's snarl, but not a whole lot about the specifics about what Iran's prepared to do. And President Rouhani did not provide us much indications about the urgency with which an agreement is needed to resolve the nuclear impasse, because Iran's nuclear program continues to advance at quite a rapid pace, and that makes much of this discussion gives an urgency to much of the discussion, because if we don't reach an agreement relatively soon, Iran will have such extensive capabilities that if it were to change its policy and decide to build a nuclear weapon, it could do so very quickly.
Just a year ago, of course, we had Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu with his big placard showing the ticking time bomb of Iran. What about that? I mean, here's the Iranian president saying we're never going to have a bomb. That sense of urgency has been presented to Americans and the world as, more or less acute in recent years. Where does that stand now? Is there any agreement on it, Patrick?
Well, I think that the United States and its allies, both in Europe and in the Middle East, are agreed that the Iranian program is reaching a size and complexity where Iran has the capability, if it wished to quite quickly produce nuclear weapons. We're talking a matter of months, perhaps a year at most, at absolute most. And Iran will before long be in a state where it could produce a weapon possibly within weeks rather than months. But Iran has taken some steps over the last year to address the most urgent concerns that Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel articulated last year. And let's hope that there's going to be more of those kinds of confidence-building measures. President Rouhani spoke about time-bound and results-oriented talks to build mutual confidence. That was the most specific and important part of his speech, as far as I was concerned.
I mean, after all, they are sitting down starting tomorrow. I suppose things could be different. Things could actually move. Mirzad, of course, you're quite right. The president pointed out this difficult history, talking about U.S. interference in Iran. There was the U.S. supported the U.S. role in overthrowing an Iranian government during the Cold War, he said explicitly from the podium yesterday. On the other hand, he said Americans see an Iranian government that's declared the United States an enemy and directly or through proxies taken American hostages, killed U.S. troops and civilians, and threatened our ally Israel with destruction. But then the president had this to say.
I don't believe this difficult history can be overcome overnight. The suspicions run too deep. But I do believe that if we can resolve the issue of Iran's nuclear program, that can serve as a major step down a long road towards a different relationship, one based on mutual interests and mutual respect.
That's a different tone. That's a big if. President of Iran, the new president, Hassan Rouhani, said, as Iranian officials have in the past, that Iran is not interested in nuclear weapons. Here's that portion of his speech.
This has been and will always be the objective of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Nuclear weapon and other weapons of mass destruction have no place in Iran's security and defense doctrine and contradict our fundamental religious and ethical convictions.
Marzad Borjerde, help us understand how you look at this nuclear issue. Do you accept that Iran's program has been for peaceful purposes for nuclear energy or not? And if you don't, what would it take for the international community, the U.S., to have confidence that it's been taken off that track?
Right. I think we need to acknowledge that there has been a lot of alarmist talk about, you know, Iran obtaining their nuclear bomb. And frankly, a lot of these sort of irresponsible talk in my thinking does not take into account the type of realities that, you know, Iranian leadership, you know, confronts. So, for example, we now talk about, you know, if Iran obtains the bomb, then this is going to lead to an arms race, nuclear arms race in the region. Well, I think there is something fundamentally wrong with this logic, considering that many argue, myself included, that this arms race has already begun. In other words, if you do have already a single nuclear power in the region,
Israel.
You cannot pretend, Israel, exactly, you cannot pretend that the other neighbors that are do not have, you know, the best of relationship with Israel should not mind, you know, Israel possessing these bombs.
Okay, let's see, so if we could pause right there. Implicit in woven into what you're saying is, as I listen through your words, yes, Iran wants a bomb. Yes, it would try and get. It doesn't sound like it's alarmist talk then. It seems to be exactly
right.
What you're
no.
suggesting.
I think what we have seen from Iran over the last, you know, 30 years is an attempt to enhance its nuclear capabilities. But I'm not convinced that the Iranian leadership has decided that they actually want to have, you know, a bomb. Look at the world through their eyes, right? They live in a region of the world which is infamous for its instability. And what do they see? They see themselves sandwiched between you know, all sorts of nuclear powers, right? From Russia, Israel, China, North Korea, India, Pakistan.
But there again, you suggest that means they would want a bomb. Or am I hearing wrong?
No, I'm saying that, look, first things first, right? If they have a genuine sense of insecurity, mm-hmm. we need to understand that. We need to address that. So the Iranians are enhancing their nuclear capabilities because they want to be sitting on the big table. They consider themselves a regional power, and they want to be acknowledged as such. If they can accomplish all of this short of a nuclear, you know, bomb, then I think this is where they are right now. And the indications that we are seeing from Iran is that take our grievances seriously. We need to have a seat. We are too powerful on account of our human capital, economic capital, geopolitical location, etc., to be left out of the equations regarding the future of the Middle East.
Patrick Lawson, do you see a sufficient change in public sentiment or the sentiment of the clerical rulers of Iran or in from the pain of sanctions that may have actually led Iran to say earnestly in its own mind, we'd rather have negotiations than a bomb, and we're ready to go there?
Well, we have an important test of this, which is that there's an international process that's been set up, an international organization called the International Atomic Energy Agency, which exists to investigate the question of whether or not a country has a nuclear weapons program or not. And unfortunately, Iran has systematically lied to the IAEA for the last 25 years, and the IAEA has, in its reports every 3 months, says that there are possible military dimensions to Iran's nuclear program and that the IAEA has not been able to resolve the questions that it has about those possible military dimensions. So we have this international mechanism embodied in international law and treaties that it is designed to resolve the question of whether or not Iran's got a nuclear weapons program. And unfortunately, Mr. Rouhani and the rest of the Iranian government continue to refuse to work with the IAEA to resolve those questions. There's a meeting set up for later this week with the IAEA IAEA in Vienna. Mm-hmm. And let's hope that Iran will begin to address the questions that the agency has had about the possible military dimensions of its program. But this body, the IAEA, is really the one to which we should look to address the question rather than what's my guess or somebody else's guess, or for that matter, what does President Obama say about the matter? And that's why it's so discouraging to see that Rouhani continues to say, we never had a nuclear program that had any military dimensions. It would be much better if Mr. Rouhani would said, look, we made some mistakes in the past. We did some things we shouldn't have in the past, and we'll explain that to you in order to establish your confidence that in the future our program, in fact, will be purely peaceful. That's what all the Security Council resolutions and the IAEA resolutions ask Iran to do, which is to reestablish international confidence in the purely peaceful intentions of Iran's nuclear program. And they call upon Iran to cooperate with the IAEA, IAEA to that purpose.
We can hear that the sense of an amenable international environment in which to do that would be important for any country to take that step. But is that step being taken? Does the change in tone get us closer? I want to bring our callers in. John in Manchester, Vermont. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener. This problem in the Middle East is so complex, and we have such failed policies in place to, you know, regarding Iraq, Syria, and the like. I think diplomacy is absolutely the way to go. I mean, let's not forget that we are the only country on Earth that has used a nuclear weapon, and I think it's, at the risk of sounding naive, I think it's incredibly arrogant of us to dictate to a sovereign nation what they can and cannot do. And, you know, the problem, I think, is centered in the fact that Ahmadinejad, you know, denies Israel's existence, denied the Holocaust, et cetera, et cetera. And I think so I understand the paranoia, but I just don't think we should be dictating. I think we should be sitting down and talking reasonably with reasonable people about reasonable solutions.
John, I've got it, but do you favor history is history, and we understand it, but do you favor nuclear non-proliferation?
I of course I do. I mean, it's the most dangerous weapon that's ever been developed, but I just don't think we can dictate to the world what you can and cannot do. Iran is an ancient country with a long history of very good things and long history with you know, science and technology and history and so forth, and I just don't think we have a place in saying you can do this and you can't do that.
John, I appreciate your call. Mirzad Borjerdi, can you see a scenario, given the pain of the sanctions, given the passage of time, maybe given a change of attitude at the top, I don't know, can you see a scenario in which diplomacy leads to Iran fully and forthrightly saying, Let's just defuse this. We're not going to go down that path. Or given the dangerous neighborhood you describe them living in, do you think there's no way they're going to give up that effort?
No, I think that possibility definitely exists. Look, I mean, it is a fact that Iran has been subjected to at least 46 sanction resolutions by U.S., U.N., and EU, you know, since 1979. And the sanctions, of course, are hurting Iran. I mean, I think, you know, we should be living in a different world if we do not acknowledge the impact of the sanctions. However, to argue that Rouhani is now presenting this set of, you know, proposals, or hopefully what he will be presenting shortly, is due to the sanctions, you know, is a bit problematical, considering that the same gentleman, Mr. Rouhani, 10 years ago exactly, signed the additional protocol that did accept, you know, all sorts of, you know, stopping enrichment, more intrusive inspection, monitoring, and so forth for Iran. So sanctions have hurt. He referred to them as a structure of violence that is, you know, hurting the general public rather than the Iranian, you know, leadership. But I think, yes, the elements are there. If there is that guarantee of no regime change, Iran's incentive for wanting to go nuclear goes down rather substantially.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the United States, Iran, and the diplomacy moment there. What's promising? What's possible? What is real? Patrick Clausen is with us this hour from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Mirzad Borgerdi is with us from the Middle East Studies program at Syracuse University. Lots of response online here. Angie says about this change of tone, the possibility of diplomacy. I'm praying it's true, she writes on Facebook, for the people's sake. Margie says, I certainly wouldn't trust them, but it's worth giving the feedback that the U.S. is open to reasonable offers. So let's respond, listen, watch. James Tuffer says, Obama meeting Rouhani reminds me of Neville Chamberlain meeting with Hitler. Hitler realized Chamberlain was weak, went ahead with the invasion of Europe. Of course, Obama and Rouhani did not, in the event, actually meet yesterday, but there's a big change of tone in the air. Here's a little bit more of President Obama talking about what might be hoped for, but also let's have this be transparent and verifiable.
We should be able to achieve a resolution that respects the rights of the Iranian people while giving the world confidence that the Iranian program is peaceful. But to succeed, conciliatory words will have to be matched by actions that are transparent and verifiable. After all, it's the Iranian government's choices that have led to the comprehensive sanctions that are currently in place.
Big U.S. ally in the region, Israel, having none of it yesterday. Here's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at a press conference at the United Nations.
Iran thinks that soothing words and token actions will enable it to continue on its path to the bomb. Like North Korea before it, Iran will try to remove sanctions by offering cosmetic concessions while preserving its ability to rapidly build a nuclear weapon at a time of its choosing.
Pretty much straight skepticism out of Israel. Mirzad Borgerdi, how do you describe what's driving this change in tone out of Iran? President Obama may have his own interest in diplomacy right now. I mean, after all, if this could be settled, it could be incredibly helpful in Syria, where there's going to have to be some kind of negotiation, presumably sometime, maybe with Hamas around Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, which he pointed to yesterday. But what's driving the change of tone now from Tehran?
Right. On your first point, I think it's absolutely the case. Look, the Obama administration talked about this pivot to Asia, but I think soon realized that Middle East is no Las Vegas. What happens there doesn't stay there. And yesterday in his talk, he identified the Iranian nuclear issue and the Syrian crisis as his top two priorities for the remainder of his term in office. After all, Obama does not want to go down in history books as the president on whose watch Iran became a nuclear power. Therefore, that's his incentive for wanting to negotiate. After all, there is a poverty of options that we are talking about here. Surely, one can also understand how the right-wing Israeli government that can be the biggest loser if there is a negotiation, serious negotiations taking place between Iran and the U.S.
Why a big loser? Why a big loser?
Well, because the Israelis have been, you know, jumping on this bandwagon or advocating, you know, sort of a military punishment for Iran. But at this point in time, neither the U.S. nor the European powers are in any mood for any type of military confrontation with Iran. I think, you know, we need to remind your listeners that, look, Iran is larger than Iraq and Afghanistan combined, both in terms of population and geographical size. If the U.S. confronted so much troubles in Iraq and Afghanistan, you can just imagine what a military confrontation with Iran would entail.
And to the question then of the change in tone, why? Why from Rouhani and why now?
Look, I think, you know, as I was referring to the 2003 additional protocol that Iran agreed to, we need to realize that there is genuine policy differences in Iran between what are they called, the reformists or the pragmatists versus the hardliners. So one is the fact that, you know, Mr. Rouhani, as a protege of the former president, you know, Rafsanjani, has a much more, you know, pragmatic orientation. He wants to take judicial expeditious steps to bring Iran back from the brink of economic collapse, again, largely having to do with the impact of the sanctions. So I'm not under any illusion that one of the major reasons for Iran to try to present a different package here is because of the economic hardships that they are facing at home. Look at it. Now, not only their oil export has gone down by half, but also what they managed to sell, half of that amount is also frozen in foreign bank accounts, and they cannot access it. And meanwhile, other countries take advantage of this situation. So, for example, the Chinese come to the Iranians and say, well, since we cannot give you back your money, why don't we sell you some, subway wagons, but at exuberant prices, right? Or the Indians insist, let's do the transactions in, Indian currency, rupee, which is going to be, beneficial to the Indian government while the price of their currency is going down.
Patrick Claussen, if this new tone is driven in part by the pain of sanctions, I mean, then isn't this what the world was looking for? Sanctions that would lead Iran to a more amenable conversation, a more open, flexible conversation, heroic flexibility, Khamenei now says, the supreme leader there. I mean, if this diplomatic effort can be put into a channel, as the president says, of transparency and verifiability, and if this is more or less what the sanctions were put in place to encourage, shouldn't the world take advantage of this?
Indeed, the Obama administration thinks that the events of the last year has demonstrated the wisdom of the path of combining an offer for open negotiations with a tough sanctions policy, that this has forced a debate in Iran about what's the right way to go, and that what we saw in the Iranian presidential elections was a public debate about whether or not the hardline stance of the previous negotiating team was correct or not. And in fact, all of the presidential candidates, except for one, rejected that kind of a hardline path. And the voters went for the person who offered the most moderate vision about which way to go forward on the nuclear impasse. And that's been very encouraging. The difficulty that we face is that time now is very short because Iran's program has advanced a lot, and that indeed, as President Obama has been saying often, that the window of diplomacy will not remain open forever, and that we need to reach an agreement on this matter sooner rather than later.
Does this keep it forced open? I mean, this is clearly the president not leaning toward military action. Does it even constrain Israel in the face of whatever Iran's doing, if the United States is in the midst of what's seen as a significant new diplomatic chapter with Iran?
Well, frankly, after policies that the Obama administration toward Syria zigged and zagged, I think there's a widespread feeling throughout the Middle East, including in countries like Saudi Arabia as well as in Israel, that the United States does not look like it's going to back up its words about its red lines with any kind of military force, and that therefore those in the region who don't want to see Iran get nuclear weapons are worried that if this diplomatic initiative stalls, if it turns out that what Iran is trying to do is to play for time while its nuclear program advances, that the United States may not follow through on its tough words about having a red line about preventing Iran getting nuclear weapons. And in that situation, if the Israelis were to use military force, this would draw an understanding from many in the Middle East about why they did it. It's interesting that in Israel in the last 2 months, the political debate has dramatically changed, and the opposition towards a potential Israeli military strike against Iran has just simply evaporated because of the sense that the United States cannot be counted upon to deliver on its red line if the diplomacy is unsuccessful. So we are in a high-wire act at the moment. If the diplomacy works, that's wonderful, and everybody will be pleased, the Israelis most of all. But on the other hand, if it turns out that the diplomacy stalls, it looks like Iran is playing for time, then we're not going to be left with very pleasant options.
Let's go to Reza calling from Boston. Hi, Reza, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to say that I don't trust the Iranian government. Being an Iranian American living in the United States for 13 years, I just think that Rouhani and his regime wants to buy time in order to lift the sanction, because sanctions has crippled the economy. And another reason, if they say that their religious belief does not allow them to have nuclear power or nuclear
weapons,
what they're doing in Syria, why they're supporting the Syrian regime, who is using weapons of mass destruction and killing innocent people. So that's why I don't trust them. And also, this Hassan Rouhani was the head of the Iranian nuclear as a negotiator 10 years ago. What did he do? Did he achieve anything? And 16 years ago, when Khatami came to power with over 90% of the vote, what did he do for Iranian people? And basically nothing. And they're just buying time to build a weapon and also at the same time remove the sanctions.
Reza, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Mirzad Barjari, what about that perspective from an Iranian-American here? And can you lay out for us what, in terms of improved relations with the United States, with the world, would make it worthwhile for Iran, for its government there, to go really earnestly go down this path that would cut off the nuclear weapons option?
Sure. First of all, I appreciate the perspective of the caller. Totally understandable. But look, here is my response to him. Let's remind ourselves, why was it that Saddam wanted a WMD, right? We realized afterwards that he really wanted it not because he wanted to attack the United States, but that he was worried about next-door neighbor, i.e. Iran. Why does the Syrians want, you know, their chemical weapons? Same thing. They are worried about, you know, using that as a leverage against the Israelis. So the Iranians might be looking at the nuclear issue along the same way. This is the perspective of the underdogs who is still thinking about how am I going to deal with the more powerful adversary who might be, you know, calling into question my existence. But I think the question that we need to ask ourselves at this point is what can Iran do? Yes, Iran can offer a series of concessions because, after all, as Patrick was pointing out, because of the work that they have done, because of the human capital that they have had, they have mastered this enrichment cycle, right? They have gone through the test. They have realized how they can do this thing. And if push comes to shove and they decide that their existence is a threat, then surely they can go, the last step. But short of that, if, as I think is really what is happening, and this is what is being offered right now, is not an attempt to buy time. This is a genuine interest because they realize that there are some structural limitations to the course of policies that they have adopted over the last 30 years, policies that have been quite destructive, self-inflicted wounds by the Iranians. So they are willing to offer some concessions. I think we will have a very quickly, we will have a test of that, what happens, you know, on Thursday and also follows up next month.
Can you see the U.S. accepting exactly what you've just described, a nuclear program that leaves Iran, not with nuclear weapons, but within, producible reach of them? Is that something the U.S. is going to accept?
I think realistically, that is the direction we are heading on. Rouhani pointed out, I do not accept anything short of enrichment on Iranian soil. You know, at what percentage this enrichment is going to take place, how much of intrusive, you know, real-time monitoring and inspections they are going to agree on, whether they are willing to sign additional protocols, etc. I think these are all going to be decided on the negotiating table. But I do see the scenario where the Iranians and the Americans both have a vested interest in trying to once and for all try to seriously address this nuclear policy. We can certainly follow on the current path of the last three decades and again have these failed policies in place 10 years down the road. But as Patrick again pointed out, that's not going to help us because those centrifuges are spinning.
Jordan in Buffalo, New York. Jordan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'll be brief. I just wanted to comment about the Israeli lobby and their economic influence over politicians in the media that will ultimately, I believe, disrupt diplomacy. First point, I think that Iran has been portrayed in a misleading way in the American media. First of all, the simplistic view that Iranian leaders have been calling for the wiping of Israel off the map, and also that they're Holocaust deniers, is very simple. A more nuanced view, I believe that the Ahmadinejad quote was actually misquoted. I think he was calling for regime change.
Ahmadinejad had some pretty florid language, but let me put this to you, Jordan. Do you see U.S. and Israeli interests coinciding here around the bomb? I mean, rhetoric aside, is there not a fundamental parallel of interest or not?
I don't think that there is, because the CIA concluded last year that there was no Iranian program for the bomb at this point. If they have better sources, I'd like to see them.
Jordan, I appreciate your call. What about the limits of where we're going, or are there limits, Patrick, with this conversation? Does President Obama have a free hand to take these negotiations where he sees most promising?
Well, interestingly enough, the country that has been firmest about insisting that we take a hard line about the Iranian nuclear program has been the government of France. And if anybody thinks that France is doing this because of the power of the Israel lobby in France or because of French love for the state of Israel, they're entitled to be nuts. The fact is that this is an issue about proliferation, and that's what's motivated the president. For many years, he's been concerned about proliferation, and he deeply believes that if, in fact, we don't resolve this Iranian nuclear impasse, then we're going to be on a path towards a world where there'll be many countries pursuing nuclear weapons. So he feels strongly that this is an issue which affects U.S. security, and that's why he's taken such a strong stand on this matter. I'm hopeful that we can reach an agreement with the Iranians, and there have been some quite creative ideas put out there about ways to allow Iran to maintain the enrichment program that it says is so important to it, while at the same time ensuring that Iran's not close to having a nuclear weapon, especially the idea that the uranium that Iran enriches would be shipped out of the country and then only made available to Iran as it needs it for its reactors. That was the basis of the Tehran Research Reactor deal that was proposed in 2009, mm-hmm. and I think we could get a variant on that as the basis for some kind of a compromise. Mm.
Well, we should be learning soon what concrete steps come out or don't come out of negotiations that are right in front of these two countries now. Change tone. We'll see what follows. Patrick Clausen with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you for being here today, Patrick.
Thank you.
And Mirzad Borgerdi with Syracuse University, the Middle East Studies program there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Great. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.